Okay, let's get started. So you're going to do this, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm pleased to introduce Dan Rice, who would be doing his dissertation defense today. So Dan joined the ASU graduate program in 2002, right?
Yeah.
2002. But before that, he was also an undergraduate student here, so he is outright ASU product. It's good or bad, we'll find out in a minute. He's going to defend his dissertation on scalable planning under uncertainty. I should point out that for those of us in the group, Dan has, it's been clear that Dan has stopped being a mere student, at least for a while, partly because he's been doing, you know, tutorials, writing tutorial articles, and being on program committees by himself. I guess, but most viscerally, because he's a visiting student, he gets to stay much closer to casinos in Las Vegas and shows up every once in a while when he likes to talk to us. We'll find out whether he actually graduated from there to all the way for to being a PhD, Dr. Dan Rice, today, based on how these things go. That's all I have to say. Go ahead. And
well, thank you all for coming. Pleasure to have you here. So the title of my dissertation is Scalable Planning Under Uncertainty. So before we get to scalable planning, let's just talk about what is planning. Basically, you can say it's finding an action sequence to achieve some goals. One example here would be NASA would be planning a mission for the Mars rover where they want to get three types of data from Mars. And they may generate a sequence of actions that looks like this, where they sample at different locations, communicate that data back to their lander until they have all of the data that they need. One way we can formulate this problem is a graph search problem, where our graph is defined as a set of states for the nodes, and then the edges correspond to actions. And what will happen is you want to find a path in this graph where you eventually go from your initial state to a state where all of the goals are satisfied. And part of the problem with doing this is that this graph is huge, where if we have p state variables describing our world, then the graph is exponential in the number of state variables. And many domains in both benchmark and practical applications have hundreds of variables, at least. So how are we going to go about doing this graph search efficiently? The reason we want to do automated planning is that manual planning can be slow and error-prone. If a human does planning, they don't necessarily always have a proof of correctness for their plans. And also, if we endow an autonomous agent with the ability to plan, then we don't need to tell it exactly how to perform every one of its duties. And there's many applications that I've listed here. I've shown a few pictures of places where planning is being used in, say, computer games, space applications, printing, manufacturing, and in defense. So in many of these applications, there's a lot of uncertainty that you have to model about the environment to find a plan that's actually going to work. And just one example of this is the Mars Pathfinder mission, which was a $265 million project. It was estimated it wasted 40 to 70% of its time because of planned failure, where the rover had a single sequence of actions, and if it failed, it had to stop, wait for the next day to get a new plan, and then continue on. So this replanning was on a daily episode, and it was very slow because you had to wait all that time. What you can do is, if incorporating uncertainty, you can find more robust plans. So some of the types of uncertainty that can cause your plan to go wrong are having incomplete information about the world, having imperfect actions that have stochastic effects, having noisy sensors, uncertain duration actions, or even having a mismatch between your model and the environment, where your model doesn't completely capture what's going on in the world. I'll be concentrating mostly on these first two for the duration of the talk. Now, because we have these two types of uncertainty, there's a couple ways that we can deal with this. First is to replan, where we wait for a failure to occur, we replan, and then this is what I showed you was happening with the Mars rover, is it would waste all this time because I had to replan. And in many cases, because you're replanning, you don't proactively see things that are going to happen, you don't prepare. This could be like, you don't put a spare tire in your trunk because you don't see that you may get a flat tire. So the way you can do that is to actually pre-plan, where there's two types of plans I'll discuss, conformant and conditional plans. Conformant plans are very similar to the plans I showed earlier where it's just a single sequence, where this can be seen as forcing the goal to be achieved despite all of your uncertainties. Then the conditional planning is you incorporate observations and you can branch your plan during execution in order to respond to runtime observations. But the problem here is that this kind of planning is very costly, even more costly than replanning. So we want to somehow scale up planning under uncertainty in order to, because we know we want these types of plans, but they're very difficult to obtain. So what I'll be talking about is a couple dimensions of planning under uncertainty, where the first dimension is the type of observability you have about the domain. Where full observability, you know the exact state of the world at every time after you execute an action. With no observability, you may start in a known state. Because your actions are uncertain and you can't observe the state of the world, you'll have what's called a belief state, where it's a set of states that you may be in. And then with partial observability, you have these actions that provide you observations, where if you perform an action with an uncertain outcome, you can get some partial information about what happened. Now, the other dimension is that you have either how you describe the uncertainty. The first is qualitative, where you just say, this is the possibility, this is the set of things that may happen. And the probabilistic case is where you have an actual distribution over these possibilities. So what I'll be talking about mostly is these four pieces here. I won't be talking about full observability, but it is a special case of these more general cases. So one way to formulate this is a search and belief state space, where previously with full observability and deterministic actions in classical planning, it was a space of states, which was exponential in the number of state variables. But now, because each of these nodes in our search graph is a set of states, it's doubly exponential in the number of propositions. So we're searching an exponentially larger space, and we still need efficient techniques in order to explore the space. So let's step back a second and see what's been done in classical planning in order to scale up plan synthesis and see if we can take this to work for us in the planning under uncertainty case. Yes?
So can you go back to this? So the actions that you have, you said you have partial observability, so do you have only one kind of action which is observed, or do you have like sensing actions in formulations, or?
Well, in this particular case, I'm just showing a conformant plan where you just want to find a single sequence. But in conditional planning, you can have actions that both have uncertain outcomes and observations. So,
and different actions can have observed different things.
Right. So this is the state of planning about 10 to 15 years ago, before they really concentrated on scaling up the synthesis of plans. This is a small domain where several planners are all exhibiting exponential behavior. And nowadays, we have planners solving more realistic problems. This is an encoding of the Munich Airport ground operations. And which one is it? Yeah. And all of these planners are solving very large instances where there's hundreds of actions in the plan. So how are they doing this? Well, they're doing state-space search, where they use these look-ahead at every search node to tell them which search path to go down. And this look-ahead is called a planning graph. It's a relaxation of the search tree that gives them some information about how good going down a particular path is. So let's look at the search graph here for our classical planning problem, where what we want is we start out at our initial state and say let's estimate what is going to be the cost to reach our goal. Now, one way to do this is to actually expand this graph and back up the values from the goal state to each of these states, indicating the shortest path. Now, in order to do this, we're actually solving the problem in order to get a heuristic to tell us what to do. So it's just as hard as actually solving the problem by brute force. The idea that's been used in planning is to come up with a relaxation of the search graph in order to give you this information at a cheaper cost. What the planning graph essentially does is you have initial proposition layer that's indicating what do we know is true now. Then we have an action layer saying what are the applicable actions given these propositions. And then we have propositions that are made true by these actions. And if you'll notice, this is a set of propositions that these propositions actually may occur in these different states, where what we're doing is ignoring the state boundaries. So in this way, we can expand this graph, and it takes polynomial time in order to do so. Now, if you look at these two layers here, every proposition that's appearing in a state at step two of this search graph is actually appearing in this proposition layer. But the converse is not true, where every subset of these propositions appears in a state. So this is the approximation going on, is because you're ignoring the state boundaries, you may think that some states are reachable that are actually not. And if we want a computer heuristic to achieve our goals, what we can do is look up the proposition layer where the goal propositions first appear, and this is going to be a lower bound on the number of actions we need to perform, because this is actually a relaxation, so it should be easier to achieve the goals. Another technique that has become very popular is called a relaxed plan, where you find your goal propositions here, and you find the actions that are needed to support them, and you backchain to support their preconditions, and so on, until you get all the way to the back to your initial layer. And these number of actions gives you an idea of what is the actual cost of the plan by reasoning about which are all the actions you need, just not the number of steps. And this tends to be more informed. So now we can go to, what am I trying to get at in this dissertation work? Can we take the techniques for scaling classical planning and adapt them to scale planning under uncertainty? And yes, it's true, we can do this. So here's a brief outline of the different chapters in my dissertation. I'll briefly touch on each of these. The first four of them are work that I discussed in my proposal, and I've extended them a little bit, and these two on the end are new since the proposal, so I'll concentrate a little bit more on those. Now, what I'll first do is talk about what it takes in order to estimate the distance between belief states, where before I showed you how to estimate the distance between states. Then, recognizing that this is very costly, we come up with a more compact representation that does the same thing at a much cheaper cost. Then, we'll also relax some of the assumptions in the model where we want to add non-uniform cost to the actions, because you can't always assume that every action has the same cost. Then, in each of these, I'll be considering state uncertainty, whether the actions are themselves deterministic. And here, in this, I will relax that to have uncertain action effects, and how does this change the reachability analysis. Then here, I'll talk about state-agnostic planning graphs, which is a technique that is usable. It's more broad than just planning around uncertainty, but it uses some of the same ideas that were developed here in Chapter 4. And then lastly, I'll talk about a new search algorithm that I developed to use some of these techniques in conditional probabilistic planning, which is the more expressive of the scenarios I'll consider. So I'll start here, Chapter 3. So now we have a belief state, and we want to reason about what's going to be the cost of a plan in order to achieve the goals from this belief state. So there's three states here. What we can do is we know how to build a planning graph for each of these states. So we'll go ahead and do that. And in each of these graphs, we can figure out what it's going to take to achieve the goal. But because we don't necessarily know if we can sense to disambiguate these states, we need to somehow aggregate the measures that we take on each of these graphs in order to get an overall idea of what it's going to take for each case in order to achieve a goal. So here we have our relaxed plans. Now, if you'll look at the layers here, there's going to be some actions that are used in common, where because this is a single sequence of actions, we don't need to necessarily execute this action more than one time. So in order to aggregate the measures across these graphs, one way to do it is to take the stepwise union of these actions, or you could also take the maximum of the different graphs or the summation. But what we found is that using the union of the steps is the best way to go. And what we'll do here is we'll compute the number of actions in this layer is 1, because we have the same action used in two graphs. Then each of these actions is different, so we'll say 3 and so forth for the first layer. So we'll say the total cost is 7. Now, this is very costly because these belief states can have an exponential number of states. And to build these each of these graphs, an exponential number of graphs for every search node in order to tell you what to do in the search is very costly. One way to do this to minimize this cost a little bit is to sample a subset of the states that you'll do the reachability analysis for. And I'll talk about a little bit more about this later. Another way is to find a more compact representation that actually notices that there's repeated structure among these graphs. If you'll notice that there's several propositions that are appearing in each of these graphs, and we don't necessarily need to represent that multiple times. So this is motivating the next chapter, where I'll talk about a more compressed version of these multiple graphs.
Yes. mentioned is something about the cost. What is the cost you're talking about?
The cost of the plan is just the number of actions in the plan. Later on, I'll get to where these actions have non-uniform costs. So your search would be in a weighted graph instead of a non-weighted graph.
Do you assume anything about the cost, the type of cost?
It's up to the domain modeler to define what the costs are.
Can you go back to the previous slide?
Yes.
So the C0 are the states and the A is the actions, right?
Right. This is the proposition layer, action layer, proposition layer, so forth.
And the three is the three actions, three different actions.
Right.
In A0, that three there, what? Which ones did act up? The sample?
The ones in red here.
Okay, because they are different actions.
Right.
So three different actions are there in this layer.
Right.
And the next in A1, how does it become three?
There's three different actions here. Sample at gamma, sample at beta, and communicate soil.
What about sample alpha or drive alpha?
Sample alpha is done here in this layer. So if you can think about this as you have three different plans, and you want to somehow execute all the actions in those plans. And this is actually looks like a plan merging problem, where you want to take these and make them all work together. But doing the actual plan merging problem is just...
No, I just want to understand. So how does it become three? You pick only the actions?
I independently find which actions are needed for each of these cases. And then I go back and aggregate them in order to get a measure.
With respect to your goal. So the other actions
right.
are not relevant to the goal. That's what you're
saying. Right. I mean, the planning graph is kind of a relaxed breadth first expansion, and then you pick out which path in that expansion that
is
corresponds.
To the goal?
Right.
Okay. So it's all because of the goal.
Right.
You said that based on some experiments, presumably, that taking the union of the actions from these three is the best.
That's right.
And that was presumably evaluated on finer performance on some set of problems.
It was also, I evaluated it with respect to the optimal plan cost. So I compared the heuristic estimate of what the plan should be to the optimal plan cost. And in all cases, doing this was the closest, where if I would take the sum, it overestimated quite a bit, because it's basically ignoring that you can perform the same action. And you can also take the max, which usually underestimates because it doesn't realize that you need to perform different actions in these different cases.
So you've actually compared the heuristic value to the actual
optimal cost.
Optimal cost. So your claim is that the heuristic was not just relatively better.
Right.
If we evaluate two plans, but in some sort of an absolute sense, it's better.
Right. Those other, taking the max or the sum, does work well in specific problems, maybe sometimes better than this, but across a whole range of problems, where those two may flip-flop depending on their performance, this consistently does well across all of them. So that's why I say it's a better measure. Because in a sense, when you're doing domain-independent planning, that's what you're after is domain independence. Okay, so looking at the graphs again, I said that there's a lot of redundant structure among these. Now, one thing you can do is just take the union of these graphs as follows, where you just represent the actions and propositions appearing in each of them once. Now, if we wanted to get a heuristic to achieve our goal, this communicate soil, we could pick up this action and this action, and that would achieve it. But what we've done here is we've lost all notion of which parts of this graph are relevant to these different states. We can recover that by propagating labels, where we label each of these propositions to correspond to which state they were coming from. So this red dot here is corresponding to this state, and everything in here that's labeled with the red dot is in the planning graph for this state. So there's no loss of information here. We're just compactly representing the multiple planning graphs by labeling the elements to correspond to where they would appear if you were to explicitly build them. The way that these labels are represented is they're propositional formulas, where the propositional formula is going to have a set of models, and that set of models corresponds exactly to the states in which the planning graph will have this element reachable. Another question? So we came up with a procedure in order to propagate these labels over the planning graph. And using this same idea, you can then extract a relaxed plan to achieve your goals. So say here, the goal is reachable by all three cases. Then we have to pick an action that achieves it for all three cases. Support its precondition, which in this case happens to be supported by different actions in each of these different cases. So what's happening here is we're implicitly aggregating these different cases, where before I was taking the union over the steps. Here, I just do it implicitly via this representation. So this is a very compact data structure. Here's some results to show, prove this to you, why this is a good idea. So what I've shown on the bottom here is, I mentioned that you could sample a subset of the states to use in the reachability analysis of each of the search nodes. And what I'm showing on the y-axis here is the total time in hours to solve all the problems in our test suite, which is about 80 problems. So what I'm doing here is using less and less, or more and more states in order to do the reachability analysis. And as you can see, using the multiple planning graph approach, where you explicitly build each one, it does prove to have some savings when you only sample a few, because you avoid this exponential cost of repeating all these graphs. And as you increase, you tend to do worse. But with the label planning graph, what we see is the opposite behavior, where if you include more of the states, you get a better performance, because what's happening is you're getting a more informed heuristic that's guiding the search better. And this, what's happening is that we're able to have a very compact representation that doesn't offset the time to find the plans.
It seems to me that this measure, I kind of believe your explanation, but it would be clearer if you had broken out the amount of time spent in the heuristic itself versus the other parts of the search software. You know?
I believe that's in the dissertation. I don't have the results on the slides.
Okay, it might be in there, and I just missed it or something. But, you know, because your conclusion is that you're saving a lot in overall performance by having better guidance.
Right, and the per node cost is actually lower.
Right, so that's what this doesn't show us, is that there's both forms of state.
Right, well, there's some domains in this set that where there's a million states. So to build a million of these planning graphs just is not feasible.
Oh, right, so that's the other thing in here, is that you've got a bunch of timeouts stuck in here, right?
Right.
That was another issue I have with this graph, is that a bunch of these problems weren't solved, and you just stuck in a 20-minute.
Right.
So we don't know how many 20-minute costs are in the different bars.
Right, but if you look at the tables in the paper, they do show that. This is to give you an idea of relatively how they perform. But the more interesting thing I show is the trend here, where if you use more of the states in an intelligent way, you get a better performance, because you're using the more information to get you a more informed heuristic.
Right. I understand that's the claim, but for example, one thing that's possible here is that the small bars have all timeouts in them, and that's the sum of 20-minute timeouts for every year, or something like that.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? You can't really tell that that's the way.
Okay.
I guess then maybe I'll say all three things.
But I mean, so is this the table that you're talking about that has the results?
There is another table. I think it's before that one, or actually, it may be in the chapter 4.
We're going to have to dig into it now.
Okay.
Let's move on. So now I'll briefly go over this one using cost-sensitive heuristics. So I'll briefly describe what's going on in classical planning in order to propagate costs. Where the idea is that we still want to extract a relaxed plan in the planning graph, but we want to somehow bias this extraction to give us a least costly relaxed plan. In order to do this, we propagate costs through the planning graph, and then when we're backchaining, we can make choices for supporting propositions based on the cost of the propagated cost of the actions. So the way that we propagate costs for an action is we can either take the max or the sum of the cost of its preconditions. Here we can say the max is 15 or the sum is 28 in order to even execute this action, because you have to support the preconditions. Then for propositions, you would take the minimum of the different actions supporting it. So here you would say, what is the cost of supporting the action plus the cost of executing the action? And here we may say that 6 plus the cost of A is the cheapest way to support proposition P. Now, when we get into labeled planning graph, what happens is we may have a cost for each of these different worlds, because if we were to explicitly build these graphs, we could do cost propagation over each of them. And this is going to be very costly in order to compute a cost for each of these states. This gets us back into the realm of where we're explicitly representing these graphs. So say we see that A is going to be reachable in this gray case. We could sum up the cost of reaching it, each of the propositions in the gray case, and then assign the cost there. We could do the similar thing for the propositions, where we take the minimum cost supporter for each of the cases. Now, this is, like I said, this is going to be very costly to do this and maintain all of these costs, which there could be an exponential number of them for each element of the planning graph. So the idea we developed here was to group the worlds and assign a cost to the groups, where if we know that A is going to be supported by, in these two cases, when we want to aggregate the cost of the preconditions, we say that whenever we need the red, it's going to be its cost is going to be 9, and we just ignore that the white case is there. So we add up all of the cases that are red, and then all the cases that have gray. But we are including an extra little cost because we don't really need to support it in this white case. And similarly, we can do the same thing for the supporting of the actions, where if we group the labels the cases for the action and assign cost to each of these, we can look at the minimum way to support them across all these cases. And what this becomes is a set cover problem, where we have the red and the gray, and these are different sets that can cover the red and the gray, and we want to choose the least cost cover. And we just happen to do this by a greedy approach, where we choose the least costly, and that covers new possibilities. And I'll describe that next. But the way that we group these cases, it can be done in multiple ways, but the simple approach we use is that the labels of the elements are going to change over time in the planning graph. So what we do is assign the groups based on what are the unique groups reaching these propositions at every level of the plan graph. So here we have the gray reaching it, and at the next level we have the red and the white reaching it, so we group those together. So in this way you have at most k groups where there's k levels of the planning graph for each of the elements, instead of an exponential number of groups where they're each just one element. So, like I said, we want to use this for relaxed plan extraction, where the important point of relaxed plan extraction is which actions are you using to support your propositions that are ultimately supporting your goals, or it may be a goal itself. So before, when we use just without cost, we would say we want to use the action that covers the most new worlds. We could choose C. But now when we have costs, we want to choose the action that covers a new world with the least cost. So we say we want to use B for the white world, because it's the least costly supporter of this whole set. Now what happens is once we choose B, it's going to change the cost of this other case, because we no longer have to perform B for the other case because it comes for free. Now, back in the coverage case, we can finish up the cover by choosing action B, which supports the white case, and we have enough actions to make sure that P is supported in all the cases. Now with costs, the next least costly supporter of a new case would be B for the red case, which because it changed to 1, and then we would choose A for the gray case. In this way, we would bias the selection of actions based on the costs. So the performance here, I'm showing a couple domains where I'm showing on here this side the total time to find a plan, and this is the quality of the plans. And using cost, we find that the quality of the plan is generally better than when we use the coverage technique to extract relaxed plans. So the only difference here is whether we're using cost to bias the extraction of relaxed plans. And we see that the total time is negligible in order to solve these problems, comparing the two approaches. And another domain, slightly more difficult one, we again get better performance using the cost approach versus the coverage, and the time here is only a little bit worse. So we say it's justified. So if there's any questions, I'll move on.
What is the problem here?
This problem is a medical problem where you have different, you don't know what the disease of the person is, so So you may perform different actions to diagnose what the disease is and then treat it based on the diagnosis. Yes?
Are we still in the conformant world?
This particular domain is actually a conditional planning domain, where you can use these same conformant planning heuristics for conditional problems, where you're just making an additional relaxation where you ignore observations. And the results in chapters 3 and 4, where the, I previously described, is also applying those techniques. I just didn't describe that here.
So the coverage versus cost here is how you pick the set cover, or is that...
Right.
But you still have the cost in the domain.
Right, you can choose to ignore it if you like, or you can take that into account. And like I said, taking into account is the right way to go. And this particular technique is a way of mitigating the computational cost of including it. Yes?
So, could you apply it? I'm not sure I got the really good here anyway. So in coverage, you're saying you pick what covers the most.
Right.
And in the cost, you pick the cheapest thing that covers something.
Right. And I realize that there is a, you would take the ratio of the cost to cover it and the number of things it covers, where I actually experimented with that and I didn't notice a big difference between using just cost and using the ratio. But I realize that's the standard greedy set cover approach.
These set cover problems are pretty small, right? On an
It depends on how many actions there are and how many different types of plans there are. And the set covers, the most actions I think I've seen, I have to recall, I think it may be 10 actions, and they all cover different subsets. So I don't, it's for a heuristic, so I don't want to go and do an optimal set cover. I don't think that makes sense. But a greedy approach works just fine. Right, but because the relaxed plan extraction itself is greedy, what actions you may choose later in the graph, even though they may be optimal set cover, they may lead you to suboptimal choices in earlier layers in the graph.
Right, but it wouldn't be too hard to actually try it and see whether or not it actually made any difference, right?
Of course. Right. So, my general theory on doing optimal things within a heuristic is that it's a bad idea. Right, so, I mean, if you want to get the best thing you can for the cheapest amount of time, and then I would cut some corners if you can. Yes?
So in this, the next line, the results that you have, these are, again, conformant plans or conditional plans?
This one is actually conditional, but it works for both. But
This particular example is conditional? Or this?
Yes.
Okay. And what for both means what?
Well, the heuristics that I'm developing, they ignore observations. So you can do them for conformant planning or for conditional planning. But in conditional planning, you're making an additional relaxation. And I found that, in general, it works pretty well, even for conditional planning. Okay, so moving on. Now we're going to move in the realm of uncertain action effects, where before, all of these were just assuming state uncertainty. But now we're going to consider some uncertain action outcomes. So how does this change things? Now, we're still going to be searching in belief state space, and now I'm going to move to the probabilistic representation where you're actually keeping a distribution over the possible states. And when you perform an uncertain action, say the sample soil action may work or not, it'll take the state that it's applicable to and it may split it into two states, one where the effect occurs and one where it doesn't. So it changes the distribution and the number of states. So what we're searching for now is a probabilistic conformant plan where we want to find a belief state where the marginal probability of satisfying the goal is above some threshold. All right? So how do we guide the search for this? Well, what we're looking at here is a reachability analysis for this belief state. This is a planning graph data structure. I'm showing it at a high level where I'm extracting all the propositions and actions. But when you have actions with uncertain outcomes, what's going to happen? Let's look a little closer at one of these cases where we have our proposition layer here and we have, say, two actions. Each of them has an uncertain outcome. So you can represent what is going to be the proposition layer given each of these different outcomes. So say outcome one occurs, then we get this proposition G. Outcome two occurs, and we don't get that proposition. Likewise here, we can have two possible cases. So in order to represent what may happen in the relaxed reachability analysis, we have to represent this branching structure to do exact probabilistic inference. But my contention is that doing exact probabilistic inference in over the top of approximate logical inference doesn't make sense. This is coming back to that point I said earlier, that it doesn't make sense to do the optimal thing when you're computing heuristic. So what I'll develop is a way of sampling these branches in the planning graph that you actually want to represent to explore some of these uncertain cases. So we'll start out with a set of samples here, and we'll sample from our initial belief state here and generate a proposition layer for each of the samples. Then when we have uncertain action outcomes, each of these samples will simulate which outcome occurs. So what you can think of is each of these paths corresponds to a deterministic plan graph. And the samples may go down the different paths based on which action outcomes they simulate. And then these red dots indicate that the goal is achievable in these layers. And we can say, what is the probability of achieving the goal after two steps? And it's just going to be the ratio of the number of samples achieving the goal. And you can continue doing this until your estimate is above the threshold you need for your particular problem. So what you're going to do is estimate the number of steps to go in order to achieve your goal with that minimum threshold. And this gets us back to the explicit representation of graphs, where we know how to represent multiple graphs with the labeled approach. So the technique that I'll show here is doing the compact representation of all these samples in one structure. So we have our belief state here, and we have four samples. Each of these samples is sampling a state from here, and then we form our initial proposition layer with the propositions appearing in these states, and we label each of them with the samples corresponding to the states. So this becomes the initial proposition layer here. We do the propagation very similar to what we did without the uncertain action outcomes. With the one difference is that when we have an uncertain outcome, we have to simulate for each of the cases if the outcome occurs. So here we see that there's two of those states in which you can apply this action, simulate the outcome, and only one of them actually occurs. So what this gives you is, after some steps, you'll have some of the samples labeling your goals. And you can say that one quarter of the samples is labeling here, so 25% probability of achieving the goal.
So what happens? So when you said one of the outcomes occurs, what happens in the other case?
Well, for each of these samples, you're simulating the action.
Okay.
Depending on what the outcomes look like,
okay,
different things will happen. In this case, I'm just representing that nothing happens. Like, there's an outcome where the action occurs, an outcome where it fails, but it could be anything. It could be just, you know, like a resource utilization where you use maybe 10 units of resource or 50 units or 100 units.
Right. The simulation will just pick one of them.
Right. So this is connected to, it's called sequential Monte Carlo. This is a technique used in Markov chains to estimate the probability of the state after number of steps. But I'm doing this over the planning graph, which is a new technique. So here's some results on a domain where I have a 10 by 10 grid, and there's a robot at a location that it'll move in its intended direction to the right with 0.8 probability and to one of these adjacent locations with 0.1 probability. And we want to find a plan to get it from the corner to the other corner. And this is a conformant planning problem where it cannot observe. So what I'm showing here is the total time to solve an instance and the plan length for that instance. And each instance is just saying, give me 0.1 probability of goal satisfaction up to 0.85 probability of goal satisfaction. So I ran the planner each time on each of these. And I'm comparing this with an optimal approach where they're only able to solve the smallest level of probability, which is a plan of about 11 actions. Is that right? Yes. So they're only able to solve it to the smallest level of probability, whereas my approach using the heuristic to guide the search, instead of they're doing more of a breadth-first search. And we're able to solve to a much higher level of probability because we're reasoning about the future in a relaxed sense, where they're doing no reasoning about the future at all. So one thing I noticed is that each of these lines is using a different number of samples in the reachability analysis for each of the nodes. And I wanted to ask, does this really add anything by using more samples or not? So I developed a variation of the problem where the robot will move in the correct direction with 0.5 probability and one of the adjacent directions with 0.25. So it makes your transition function much more stochastic. And what will happen is your belief state will be much more broad and harder to capture with samples. So what I found is that using only 4 samples per reachability analysis had a limited utility. It could only solve problems up to 0.35 probability, whereas using more samples, I could scale out further. So this is what true to what we know about Monte Carlo, is that using more samples gives you a better informedness or better estimate. In this case, it pays off because it's not too costly in order to do that. Okay, so let's see here. Now we'll move to an approach called state-agnostic planning graphs, where we recognize that any type of search where you're reasoning about the future, that in building planning graphs in order to do this, there's maybe redundant structure. Here, before I talked about redundant structure across the different possible states, where now there may be redundant structure between, say, a parent and a child in the search. So if you look at this plan for a classical planning problem, that there are these states in this following sequence of actions. If you were to build the planning graph for the first state, you would use these parts of the structure in order to do the reachability analysis. Now, if you were built for the second state, you'd use these portions, and there's a significant overlap there. For the third, there's also more overlap. The fourth, more overlap. So what we can do is do this reachability analysis for all these states at once by building the planning graph or labeled planning graph for the hypothetical belief that you're in any state. And then when we reach one of these states, we just have to pick out the portion of it that's relevant to that state. So what happens in classical planning is you can build the heuristic for every state before you even start searching. And then the per node cost is amortized over the cost of computing this ahead of time. So here's some results comparing this approach where in classical planning where you would build this structure before search versus building it at every search node just for that specific node. And this is the performance. On this side is an XY axis or XY plot of the performance on the same instance of using the state agnostic graph versus using a planning graph. We find there's many cases where using the planning graph takes considerably less time than it does the regular planning graph. And there are a few cases where it does make sense to use a planning graph because sometimes it's wasted effort doing all of this reachability analysis for all states when you only need it for, say, a particular path in the search space. But we also know, here I'm showing also the ratio of the runtime, where above this line here, this is even, and using the state agnostic approach, this is the multiplicative speed up by using it. So generally, as the total time to solve the instance increases, you get more bang for the buck by using the state agnostic graph because you're actually using more of it.
Can you talk about what domains were that graph?
I think they were on 2002 IPC.
So which ones are actually below the line there?
I believe it was Blocks World.
Below.
It was below. Because there was very little bit of the reachable state space that you actually use in the search. I'm not certain on that fact. I have to go back and double check.
Each of the data points is probably unrelated to the other.
Right.
There
well, actually, there are several instances of the different domains. I think there's about 6 domains. So most of the trends were, you know, relative to the domain. Generally, with using the state agnostic graph, you may build it for unreachable states. So there may be a logical state that is never reachable because of the actions that you have. And that's wasted effort because you'll never evaluate the heuristic for that state. So in non-deterministic planning, we can also do this idea where we want to build the heuristic for this belief state. We know how to build the labeled planning graph for this. And we use these particular actions. Then when you build a planning graph for the next one, there's going to be some significant overlap here also. So what we can do is build the planning graph for every state that would appear in one of these belief states. And it just so happens that the planet graph would be the same size as it would be in the classical planning sense, despite whether or not we have uncertainty. So when you need a heuristic for, say, this belief state, you would pick out all portions of this planning graph that have the labels corresponding to those states. And when the states are shared between graphs, like say this pink dot here, you actually get to reuse that same portion of the planning graph. So the speed up here is going to be even greater. Okay, so here's some results from the last year's planning competition where I competed with this planner using this idea. And these are all conformant planning problems. And what we see in green is the performance of my planner. And so I have several instances across the x-axis in total time for each of the domains. And there are some domains where it doesn't perform as well as the other competing approaches. But if you'll notice, it performs well across all of the domains. And this is something I'm really after with the domain-independent heuristic, is that if you don't know what's going to work well in your problem, you can use this, and it should give you some reasonable performance. And so I would say it's a versatile heuristic, and that's what I hit upon earlier with what the heuristic is estimating.
And can you say what the blue line is?
That would be T0. That's Hector Geffner and Hector Palacios. What they did is they translated the conformant planning instance to a classical planning instance, and there's particular structure in some domains where it's not exponential translation, and they were able to exploit those, and they used FF to solve the classical instance. Yes?
Well, as I recall, you did some experiments with on classical planning, not conformant planning.
Right.
Using say. And is it the case that a planner like FF, for example, it's not completely rebuilding the planning graph at each stage from scratch, right? It's reusing some of the work.
Right.
For example,
so there's this thing called a bi-level planning graph. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, I was thinking more that, if they progress forward one state, right, you can basically chop off the first state and reduce some propagation.
Right.
Graph, you don't have to rebuild the whole thing from scratch.
Right, but you have to pass through it and cut out the junk that you don't need.
Yeah. I'm assuming that that's what they do. That they do something.
I don't believe they do.
They don't. They just rebuild the whole thing from scratch again?
To my knowledge, yes.
What they have is they have this very special state of the that they develop through
so what they have is a structure that's just an action layer and a proposition layer, and they have a bunch of arcs representing the connectivity, and then they just propagate through that each time, but they don't have to rebuild it each time. They just, all they're doing is propagating like an integer saying which level it appears at. So this also works in stochastic planning. This is something new since I proposed, where I'm applying this to conformant probabilistic planning. Now, what we do in conformant probabilistic planning is we generate a set of samples for each of these states. So we have multiple samples per state, just because we have to represent the distribution. And then we get this graph labeled as so, and we have to sample the action outcomes like I described. Do the same thing for the next state, you have to generate some samples. And again, we see there's a lot of significant overlap here. So one idea is to generate a set of planning graphs ahead of time. So if we are going to use the most n samples per belief state, we would build n planning graphs for each of these states. And we could represent them symbolically like I described. So when we want to compute the heuristic, say, for this first belief state, we would choose 4 samples of these 8 planning graphs corresponding to the distribution of those states. So we have to decide for the first sample which state is it coming from. So here we pick this state. For the second sample, we have to choose which state it's coming from, and so on. So then we're identifying 4 of the planning graphs that are represented implicitly within the structure that we use to compute the heuristic. So the complexity of doing this, to build this structure ahead of time for all of the states, is if we have S states, N samples per search node, A actions, and K levels of the plan graph, we have SNA to the power K. And the main thing I'm interested in is that this depends on the number of states, which can be quite large in many problems. So what I developed is an approach called the common sample seg. This is something I think that's used in simulation a lot, where they reuse samples instead of to compare different choices. Here what I'm using is I'm reusing samples to compare search nodes. So this looks a really busy picture, but what's going on is that for each of these states, I have these samples that are corresponding to different states, or samples for each of the states. And when I have an uncertain action outcome, is I draw just, if I have four samples for each state, I draw four samples of the outcome of that action. So what happens is, I say, for the first type of sample, does this action outcome occur? For the second type of sample, does this action occur? For the third, and so on. And it happens for the fourth type, this cross, the outcome does not occur. So I see for all these cases where this action may be applicable, any case where I have to use the cross here will not appear to support this proposition later on, where the cross is coming from this other proposition, from the persistence of this proposition. And what this does is that I'm using common samples of the action outcomes for all of the planning graphs for the different states. So if I say this is a planning graph of type 1, type 2, type 3, type 4, I only say what's going to happen of all of the types of type 1, what's going to happen of all the types of type 2, and so forth. Now what this does is it gets my number of samples down by abstracting out the number of states. So in this way, no matter which state is using the planning graph, if it has to use this action, it will only use some, it won't have to regenerate the action outcome for every individual state. So the performance of this is pretty dramatic in some domains. What I'm showing here is a logistics problem and the grid problem I showed you earlier, where I'm showing the total time and the probability of goal satisfaction that's required. So the previous approach I called the glug, where I was building it for each search node, and here I'm building the whole thing ahead of time before search. So as we see, this is a really challenging problem before using this approach, where I could only solve it to 0.15 probability of goal satisfaction, and now I can go to 0.95 probability of goal satisfaction by using the common samples. And then in the grid problem, I see another good result where the total time is probably about half of what it would be if I used the McLug. So this seems like a good idea. That translates also to the stochastic case. See how much time I have here. Okay, so this is the last chapter where I am going to be describing conditional probabilistic planning, a new approach to doing this. Before, I was just describing probabilistic conformant planning, which is a much simpler search problem, where the idea is that you want to find a path in your search graph where the marginal probability of the goal in your belief is across your threshold. But now, when you have a conditional plan, what may happen is that if it starts with an action with two outcomes, and you want to still achieve the goal with a certain threshold, it's very tricky to determine which of these subplans I should execute under each of these branches in order to achieve that threshold. So if I say my threshold is 0.6, do I choose these two very costly plans to execute in these different cases, or will I choose one of the costly plans and one of the cheap plans? It's not immediately obvious what you should do in one branch without considering what's going on in the other branches. So if you'll see, I'm plotting these two options on a graph here where you can see that they are non-dominated. That one, you can't say really say that one is better than the other, just say that one achieves the goal with different probability and one achieves it with different cost. And, yes?
Minimizing the cost.
Well, the general probabilistic planning is defined as minimal cost to exceed a threshold of goal probability. But to even determine whether these choices are going to exceed that threshold, I won't know by looking at these nodes individually. I have to look at their parent. So what's going on is I have to combine these plans, take the expectation of them, and here we see that there's four possible plans I can perform, where I execute A and then I execute one of the two subplans in each of these branches. And each of these is going to have a different probability and cost. So how do we go about, what we ultimately want is a plan that exceeds our threshold. So if we draw a line across here where our threshold is for the probability, We want the one with minimal cost. But also we can find a proto set of plans if we so desired.
Yeah.
Yes?
Can you give me an intuitive example of this kind of problem?
A conditional planning problem?
A problem where, give me the intuition behind what's the problem in this situation.
Let's say it's a medical diagnosis problem where you perform a test to determine which disease a person has. And in one case, it's, say, cancer. In one case, it's not cancer. There's two plans you could perform if they have cancer. One may be very costly, one may be very successful. In the other case, they don't have cancer, but say they have a tumor. There's probably two different ways you could remove the tumor.
What are the multiple objectives here?
You want to minimize the cost of the expected cost of the plan, and you want to at least achieve your probability of goal satisfaction. The problem here is that this is not exactly a multi-objective problem, but I have to formulate it as multiple objectives because you can't decide at any of these nodes that one dominates in both objectives. So it's only at the root that I can say, for my one objective, which is minimal cost, which choice of plans in these different branches is the right choice. So the way that I formulate this is a multi-objective dynamic programming. It's just the math. I won't go into too much detail on it, but the idea is that for each of the belief states, you keep a proto set that is a vector of n objectives. And you want to make sure that each point in your proto set is non-dominated, where non-dominated just means that it's better in, it's as good in all objectives and strictly better in at least one. And I compute expected cost and probability of goal satisfaction as follows by just taking the expectation of these different plan branches and adding up the costs, and then also taking the expectation of probability of satisfying the goal. So I'll give you a little run through of the algorithm just to give you an idea of how it works. So we start out with our root node here where we say the goal is satisfied with zero probability, and we could say that we have a null plan here that achieves the goal of no probability and no cost. And then we can also have a point here that is called a heuristic point that'll help us guide the search, saying, this is my estimated cost to satisfy the goal of high probability. Now, when I expand this node to apply all the applicable actions, say I have one sensory action and one causative action, for each of these, I have to initialize their proto set with a heuristic and the null plan. Now I have to back up these values to the root node to tell me which of these do I want to search further on. And here, it's only based on the heuristic estimate of the subplans. So I say that by taking the expectation of these two heuristic points is going to be lower than this heuristic point. So then I expand the plan under this subtree. So I go ahead and expand the plan, and I find that these two belief states are actually satisfying the goal with some non-zero probability. So what I have here is that the null plan at this node is actually satisfying the goal of some probability. Then what I want to do is I want to propagate this information back to the root. So here, at this step, I compute what is the cost of a plan that starts with A3 at this node and the probability, and what is the heuristic estimate of expanding another plan under this node. And I do the same thing over here. And now what I have to do is I have an actual solution now where I can execute plan A1 and A4 and A3 in each of these branches to achieve the goal with some non-zero probability, which is the expectation of these two. And then I have a heuristic point telling me which of these two subplans is better based on the heuristic points that were propagated backwards. Now I expand again, and here I see that there's no applicable action. And here I see that I achieve the goal with a little bit more probability. Now, I back these values up, and here what you see is that the cost increases considerably for the heuristic point because it's actually infinite because there's no subplan that I can expand under this node. And here there's two subplans, either do action A7 or do action A7 and keep expanding further. So I have another couple plans here that I back up, and I continue down here. So now I have two plans. One is to execute up to this point, and then the other plan is to execute a little bit further. And these are non-dominated. But now what we see is my heuristic point because this was infinite, it changes which subplan I think is optimal. So now I thought that A2 is going to give me a better plan. So I expand A2 and find its children. And I see that one of its children satisfies the goal 0.1 probability. So then I can back up their values. And now I have another plan at the root that is summarizing this branch. Yeah, if I do A2, A5. And what happens is that plan gets pruned because it actually satisfies the goal with the same cost as this other plan, but this plan has a higher probability of goal satisfaction. So then I still think that my heuristic point is best through A2, A6, so then I expand A6 and get its child, and I propagate this back through the graph. And now that I've propagated all these subplans through the graph, I find here that there's these possible plans. But if you'll notice that this node and this node are dominated because these other two satisfy it with more probability and at a lower cost. So then what I can say is I have two subplans here that achieve the goal with some probability and some cost. And if I have a threshold, I can cut off here and say, this is my final plan if it exceeds that threshold. And obviously I'm using this McLug heuristic in order to initialize these points. So this is a pretty challenging problem because these protosets can grow exponentially. Yes? So I think Malcolm had a paper on this at Lisp, Ichkai, where you're going to find a plan that may be very low, very high cost. And he was assuming that you can achieve the goal with 1.0 probability, because that's what non-deterministic planners do, is they find strong plans where it guarantees goal satisfaction. Because if you don't have probabilities, you don't know how strong or how weak the plan is. So in that case, it may not work in some domains where it's just not possible to achieve the goal with 100% probability. So that's the disadvantage of using that. Okay, so running short on time, and I'll just breeze through this pretty quickly, but we wanted to reduce the size of the Pareto sets by using a notion of epsilon domination, which I'll describe next. This is actually explored by Papadimitriou in a caucus in a web service. I think it had to do something to do with multiple web services. But anyway, I also use the reachability heuristic, which I won't get into because I described it. But so epsilon domination, say we have a Pareto curve here. I'm showing 1 minus the probability of the goal just to give you a minimization as your criterion. And what Papadimitriou explored is that if you overlay a grid like this where each hyperrectangle is the 1 over epsilon, each side of the hyperrectangle is 1 over epsilon of the ratio of the two sides of it, then what this indicates is that you're going to have a single Pareto point in each of these boxes. So say let's try to add a point here that it clearly dominates this other point. But when we multiply it by 1 plus epsilon, it doesn't dominate because we only want to approximate this Pareto curve. We don't want to represent every single point. Now, if we want to add another point, say in this rectangle, if we multiply it by 1 plus epsilon, it is non-dominated. So you can see that they have a proof in their paper where they say that in every one of these rectangles, we're going to have a single solution. And that's what we're after, is if we vary epsilon, then we can get a more or less approximate representation of the Pareto curves. This is going to greatly help us in the dynamic programming in the search algorithm. So there's a few results comparing this approach to a optimal stochastic satisfiability encoding of the problem, where what we see is that as we increase epsilon, our time to take to solve these problems decreases. And because we have a different representation of plans where we don't assume that all plan branches are the same length, we can actually find cheaper cost plans than the optimal planner because we don't try to do actions to make all the branches the same length. Here's some results showing using the heuristic. Those previous results were just doing breadth first search, where here what I'm showing is the three problems that are very large, the number of actions is around 2,000. 200 and over a couple hundred propositions. So the state space is very large. And first one is first responders. It's kind of like a logistics problem, but it's for first responders to put out fires and save victims and that sort of thing. And we can see that using the heuristic, it allows us to scale, to find plans of pretty high expected cost. And this number here is the number of nodes in the plan, saying how many points do we have to decide action to perform. So these plans are pretty large. And this number here indicates the how branchy the plan is. It's the number of nodes that have they're reached by two different paths of the plan. And then here I have the number of terminal nodes in the plan where you just don't do any actions. So it indicates how branchy the plan is, how many branches are. We see in this particular problem, we have about an expected cost of 23 and 104 branches, which is a pretty large plan. And it's larger than anything that has been in conditional probabilistic planning before. I won't talk about this right now. I'll maybe come back to it. So I'll summarize now, since I'm running short. What I described was several techniques for using planning graph heuristics to search in belief space, which is intended to scale up planning under uncertainty. What I defined is several types of distance measures that both use non-uniform and non-uniform costs, and I found ways of computing those estimates using planning graphs in both non-deterministic and probabilistic cases. Then I found efficient ways of computing these heuristics by doing label propagation, grouping costs, using Monte Carlo, and using state agnosticism. And then I also described a multi-objective search algorithm for search in belief space to find conditional probabilistic plans that can use a reachability heuristic. And then there's several points of future work that expand upon this, such as using heuristics to help you do planning and execution, dealing with another type of uncertainty, which is incomplete domain theory, using observations in the reachability heuristics where I ignored observations, and then also defining heuristics for decision theoretic problems, and using the multi-objective formulation to find diverse plans. So I'll conclude there, just list some of the publications relevant to here. Should probably blank out this line because this is under blind review, but I'll take any questions that you may have. So recover some of those points that you would have pruned otherwise? Sure. The point, if you've expanded that search space, you may have generated a point that represents that subplan for that part of the search space, but you just happen to prune it. But it's still existing in memory in your search graph. So all you would have to do is go back and back up that state again, but change your epsilon.
Now does that actually save you?
He would be doing the same work at a finer epsilon. This is a very rudimentary way of computing the state backups, where I just compute all possibilities of what you can perform at every action, and choose the non-dominated ones. But I don't do any sort of memoization to figure out which ones are going to be clearly dominated and you don't need to consider again.
Does the epsilon, does it depend on the cardinality of your Pareto set? I mean, if you have more points to begin with, you have a smaller epsilon?
You define epsilon yourself. So you can choose whatever it may be.
But eventually every box only has one solution point.
Right. Well, to give you an idea of how it works is that, say you have an epsilon of 0.1, and I'm finding plans with different probabilities. So I'll only find a plan with around 0.1 probability, I'll only find another plan with about 0.2 probability, and so on. So that each of the plans is kind of spaced by that epsilon in each of the objectives. And it just so happens that in these conditional plans, you may just be able to tweak one of the branches just a little bit by, say, performing or not performing an action, and it's very similar plan. So it doesn't make sense to keep track of both of those. So the epsilon will prune it out.
Okay. is it almost saying like you're fixing one objective and trying to do as good in the other?
No, that's one, it applies to all objectives. I can show you the formulation of it. So you're saying for all I that in order for Q prime to dominate, it has to be better by 1 plus epsilon.
Yes. Subject back, you were talking about cross propagation.
Right.
Line graphs. As you know, you can also do probability propagation.
Right.
Line graphs, right? And so I'm wondering whether or not, in the case of the multi objective, if it would make any sense to do some sort of, generate some sort of Pareto set of relaxed plans in order to help guide
sure.
your search. And
well, if you recall that NSF proposal we submitted, we said exactly that, where we propagate a Pareto set over the planning graph for the cost and probabilities, and then extract the relaxed plans based on those. So in using this labeling technique, you may be able to leverage that to summarize this Pareto set compactly.
So I'm a patient, and you're my doctor, and you say, I have a plan for how I'm going to treat you, and it's trying to optimize, it's trying to achieve that you'll be cured with 95% probability, and I'm trying to minimize costs across that. And you say, so what I've done is I've propagated all this stuff out, it turns out to be a really hard planning problem, but I figured out that what I should do is action A1, and that's perform this test on you.
Right.
And unfortunately, I get the 20% likelihood thing that says, gee, you're going south because you've got something bad. And you say, well, good thing I considered that you might have not been sick because my optimal plan says I don't actually treat you.
Right.
Because, too bad, 80% of the time I do that test and you're fine, and you get me that 90, you know, overall, when you are sick in a different way, I do really expensive things, but I save you all the time. And you, sorry, sucker, you fell down
right.
the middle path, and you're sort of medium sick and really expensive to cure, so I'm not going to bother. Tough luck. Now, why is that the right answer?
Well, so it depends. Are you the HMO or are you the patient?
I said right up front, I'm the patient. Knock on wood. I'm the patient.
Okay, so if you're the patient, then this probably doesn't make sense for you. Because when you go down that path, you want the highest probability possible. But the HMO, they may say that we're going to be treating multiple patients. We're going to be executing this plan multiple times, and we want to lower the overall expected cost of this plan because we don't have billions of dollars to spend on these people. And they want to guarantee a certain level of quality, saying we'll save 80% or 90% or whatever percent of people, but they can't justify that by exploding the costs astronomically. So if you're the patient, then I would say set your probability threshold as high as you possibly can. And if you're the HMO, then maybe make a different choice.
Good, thank you.
I have a question about the representation that you're using. So you have basically point value estimates for the cost and the probability.
Right.
At least as those were in the case of the distribution.
That's right.
Well, okay. So that makes me wonder about a couple of things. One thing is basically about other representations. So you could imagine in some of your when you're doing some of these operations and having interval representations for cost might allow you to make further abstractions. Two possible things are very similar in cost. You can sort of merge them and just have a slightly relaxed interval.
Right.
And the other is that in some cases you might get a better notion of the goodness of one plan versus another by including some estimate of not just the probability value but the variance. So I'm wondering if you could sort of talk about your choice of representation,
like
point estimates.
Right. Well, the point estimates is probably the most simple thing you could do. That's why we did it first. And I thought about other approaches for doing this. Where essentially the idea is that you can change your expected cost by choosing to execute the subplan or not. So with a certain probability, you may or may not execute that subplan. And what this will actually give you is it'll, if I have a whiteboard here. So if you have your probability and cost here, and say this is one of your points, then you can actually achieve any point along here by just choosing to execute the subplan with a certain probability to achieve each of those points. So it'll lower your overall expected cost and your probability of goal satisfaction. So if you have another point here, it may clearly dominate in terms of the probability, so you could just prune this point. And actually, anything under here would be pruned based on this line. So what you would end up with is a type of, let me see how this works. So if you had another point here, this is actually the optimal thing to do up until here, because this plan won't work for any higher probability. Sorry, I have that backwards. So maybe it's the other way around. So if you have this point here, you have two plans you could execute. This one is dominating over this interval here, and this one is dominating over this interval here. And what you have to just remember is a subset of these points, and hopefully you'll get much fewer points you have to use to represent the Pareto curve. So this relies on being able to probabilistically execute a subplan. And this is I think it may be a more compact representation, but I haven't explored it in much detail.
You're finding a plan, right? Not finding a optimal plan.
Right.
So when you do this experiment, I know most people do in the planning community. You have a suite of problems and you're testing that. Do some people do, like, say, randomly generate a planning problem and try to see how the algorithms work, or that approach is not followed?
I believe they do that in the competition,
okay,
where they randomly generate problems, but it's
actually we did randomly generate.
So that is
in your work.
Oh,
our
right.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason I'm coming from is, like, actually I'm doing a different thing, and we were talking about the complexity, and like I was telling my colleague, like Mama Psyker, saying, okay, this thing is this t-space or something, and then he said, no, once you know the problem, it's not t-space anymore.
Right.
So
if you're
it's a slightly different thing. Once you, of course, you're not specifically using it. I mean, you're not using that example to make your thing hard code anything. But and that got me thinking. It just happened yesterday, and that got me thinking that why more people do not do like random generated problems.
I mean, there's also work basically. I mean, there's not that much I think on computation, but there's also usage internet. But it hasn't taken off at the level, for example, like the CSP kind of thing. Because the domain, random domain, it's not very.
But there's another argument.
More.
But there is another argument. In general, they, all those experiments that do the SAT thing, I mean, they have all those phase transitions and all that stuff, and then they say, okay, realistic problem, maybe you don't get there.
Yeah.
So that could be the argument used.
Right.
I mean, actually, that's fine.
So I guess that's part of the philosophical question of whether how you direct your research. Do you want to be trying to solve practical problems, or do you want to solve the hardest instances? And typically in the planning community, it's gone towards modeling real-world problems that are of practical interest. So.
No, but that said, there are people who are also doing this, but not anywhere near the amount that's done in CSP here. I think partly because the number of parameters are fewer. Here it's like, you can generate kind of random with respect to our distribution. It's like a
yes.
Regarding uncertainty, so you started with the Marshall problem, right? And coming back to the question of cost, so can you handle other techniques in the planning experiment to handle the uncertain cost in the terms of, for example, your cost is the consumption of energy, right? And so this energy consumption depends on a lot of factors, and can you take into account that there may be uncertainty in
Right. I have some unpublished work that addresses that, where when you have uncertain action outcomes, you can assign a cost just to the action itself or to the cost of the action. I mean, the cost of the outcome. So, I had this one problem where it was a robot navigating over a hilly terrain, and the cost was associated with its change in elevation. That because the robot is not able to completely control the direction it goes, if it has this uncertain outcome where it actually goes uphill, it incurs a higher cost because it uses more energy. So all you really need to do is define cost in terms of outcomes instead of the cost of executing the action. And there, the cost would follow the same distribution as the outcomes.
There's also the connection, I guess, between the systems, but there's also the connection between the multi-objectivity and diverse plan. Because once you start having, if you don't know enough about the cost, and if you know, and if there's uncertainty about the cost, then that sometimes can be handled by having multiple plans that are available. That's a very good point.
Right, but to elaborate, there's not been a whole lot of work on that area. There in the MDP community, it depends. They have addressed that to a certain extent, where it depends on how they define their reward function. Sometimes they just do it based on the action you perform, or it's based on the state transition you make.
What do these resilience do, the one that we were interested in the last speech by?
Oh.
The risk mighty and uncertain.
Right.
I love that.
It's connected to a question I was asked in the proposal, where how do you combine non-deterministic planning with probabilistic planning?
Yeah.
And
so there they were thinking there's uncertainty in the probability itself, right? That's
well,
the
no, they have, that's in between the two. Is non-determinism is you don't know anything about the probabilities.
Yeah, exactly.
Probabilistic is you know exactly what they are. And there's like Demeter Schaefer that's kind of in between. And they were just doing with the two extremes where if they had an action with uncertain outcomes, they would have a non-deterministic choice over probabilistic outcomes. And your colleague, Thomas Spider, had a paper on similar sort of thing in just representing belief states, saying that you could either represent them as a set of probability distributions, or you could have them as a probability distribution over sets. And in that way, you can combine the two. But the people from Brazil, they actually showed that it was lower complexity to assume one have a non-deterministic choice over probabilistic outcomes, because they're using an MDP where they have to do these state backups to do value iteration. And they showed that it was actually lower complexity to do it that way. I'm not completely convinced, but
planning graphs that you showed were mostly, most of the actions were kind of world-changing actions, right? So if they are, say, purely sensing actions, will the graph be similar or is there a difference? Or what is it?
Yes. What happens if you're familiar with sensory graph plan?
Somebody
knows the answer. But, the thing is that you have, when you have this type of uncertainty over the state, and you want to perform actions, there may be what's called a cross-world mutex. We're saying that if I do one action for one case and I do another action for another case, those actions are going to conflict.
So all those graphs that you showed us or in your work, I mean, is it a minor change to take account purely sensing actions? I have heard the term sensory graph plan.
Right. It's fairly tightly connected with mutex constraint propagation.
Okay. Where
a sensory action, what it'll do is it'll remove mutexes. And that essentially means that if you have two actions that are conflicting, if you put them into separate branches of the plan, they'll no longer conflict.
No, I understand. But will all those things, all the propagation, everything that you saw, will they carry over to such graphs? In other words, does it won't carry over to that graph?
Right. In my JARA article, I do describe this type of propagation. For just doing the mutex propagation. And then once you have that, then you can start reasoning about how observations change the mutexes. And it was too costly just to even propagate those mutexes to justify reasoning about the observations. And besides, ignoring all the mutexes and not using observations worked well anyway.
No, I'm just trying to find your space, like what you brought to solve.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a lot of work, a lot of achievements. I'm just trying to find your space.
Okay.
Other questions? Proceed.
they will be, so the open questions will end and then there will be a separate committee. So are there any other open questions? Thanks very much. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much.
And thanks in particular to the two Daves who had to travel on the plane to come here.
Please take refreshments with you. And
if
should I record this session, or?
Yeah, you probably shouldn't.
Okay.